Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Tyrannosaurus Chicken? Y'all like Tyrannosaurus Chicken? Winner of the 2011 Arkansas Times Artist of the Year, Fort Smith duo Tyrannosaurus Chicken is, quote, primal and progressive, foreign and familiar, abrasively gritty, and technically brilliant. More can be found at ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on the road and on location at the incredible Arts Center of the Ozarks in Springdale, Arkansas, up in the beautiful northwest corner of the state. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is made possible in part by the Arkansas Arts Council's Arts on Tour program, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my left here is Stephen Pigman from the Fayetteville band Mountain Shore, providing our music for tonight's show. Thank you, Stephen. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? When we go on the road, we bring a few pieces of our regular set with us, which are these two pieces right in the middle, which are amazing screen doors from her Images of the American South collection by Delta artist V.L. Cox. More can be seen at greatfineart.com. We also like to feature an artist from the area, so tonight's featured artist is Eureka Springs, Arkansas painter Ken Addington, and these pieces are Ken's over here, and we're featuring this piece right here in the middle, which is entitled, So I Went On and Told Her, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Ken at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, just like we are, our storytellers find themselves on the road, whether it's in transit or at an interesting destination. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Russell Geyer heads south to the Big Easy, and we'll end the night with Vicki Taylor Penny on a dark two-lane highway. But let's start the night with Linda Summersee as she and friends load into the Cadillac in Destination Juke Joint.
It was a cold winter night in 1993, and we were hanging out in Helena, Arkansas, having poured Jack and Cokes all around. I was flipping through my rockabilly DJ friend Mike's enviable collection of blues CDs. "You ever been to a juke joint?" his wife Darla asked. "No," I replied, looking at the CD jacket I was reading. "Why not?" I was there in the land of the blues, but my path hadn't crossed a juke joint, and I hadn't gone looking for one. Junior Kimbrough's was closed that night, and just as well, because it's a long drive to Tullahoma, Mississippi. So we set out for Margaret's Blue Diamond Lounge in Clarksdale. "But I haven't finished my drink," I said. "Don't worry," Darla said. "They don't bust white people down here." It had all begun a year earlier with an interview in Little Rock, where a bespectacled lady on the far side of a wide conference table aggressively questioned my Yankee-accented ability to provide a meaningful teaching experience in the Mississippi Delta, a flat stretch of land between Memphis and Vicksburg with ultra-fertile soil that makes it a really fine place for growing cotton and music. How would you apply your fiber arts, your quilting and basketry to the black experience to a black student in the Delta, she tested. "Well," I said, thoughtfully and sincerely, "I'd tell them about the quilts that their ancestors stitched, how those quilts had to function as both coat and bedroll when the Civil War ended and the slaves left the plantations. I'd tell them about the colors of Africa that were sewn into those quilts, the oranges vibrating with the searing African sun, the greens remembering the lush African vegetation. And the baskets? Well, I'd tell them about the gullah baskets that the slaves wove during mosquito-infested summers on the eastern seaboard, just exactly like the baskets of West Africa. Tightly coiled sweetgrass, stitched with palmetto. Shortly thereafter, I was officially in Arkansas Artist in Education, sharing the first of many teaching residencies on the Arkansas side of the river. I was staying with a sweet couple from Mariana who gave me free room and board. I remember the clear, sunny mornings in September when I drove south along Route 1 and then west on Highway 49. The last ghosts of summer rose up on the lingering mist, hovering over fields of ripening cotton, then drifted off toward Crowley's Ridge. I had the windows rolled down, and sometimes I'd pull over to pencil a few lines of poetry with fresh feelings of joy that swelled my heart to be here in this place at this time in my life. Poetry that would eventually end up stamped along the borders of my Quilting with the Blues series. When I went home for the weekend, I sometimes stitched till 4 a.m., listening to Buddy Guy and Eric Clapton until I shut off my studio light and crunched down the gravel path in the moonlight, my eyes aching all-nighter bloodshot red. Soon, it was the January night before Quilting with the Blues opened at the Delta Cultural Center. Roger and I were to stay with friends Darla and Mike in their bungalow in Helena. That's how, drinks in hand, we came to pile into Darla and Mike's beige and brown 1978 Cadillac Fleetwood four-door hardtop with the cloth ceiling that was coming undone in the back so that it grazed the top of your head as you succumbed to its lush, upholstered interior, heading to a juke joint. Darla had on a retro white wool swing coat with a matching pillbox hat and white cat's eye glasses, her hair pinned up in a French twist. A Polaroid land camera hung from her wrist, loaded with fresh film. As we crossed the Helena Bridge at twilight, tugboats on the river were pushing barges to New Orleans, slowly, carving through the deep black water. Red lights, winking, winking. We began slowly crisscrossing the back streets near the railroad tracks, looking for Margaret's Blue Diamond. "Take a right," said Darla. "I think it's down here." Without warning, a young black man sprung out, pounding menacingly on the trunk of the car. "Hey, white boy," he challenged. Instantly, Darla turned around. "We're here, this is it," she said excitedly, paying no never mind to the young man's shout. Mike jammed on the brakes, fishtailing into the dusty parking lot, skidding to a halt before a weathered gray building that leaned under a rusty tin roof. There were no windows to bar. At the entrance, a guy with a clutch of money was working the door. He sneered. "What you want here, white boy?" Roger shrugged. "We came to listen to some good music," he said, matter-of-factly. Inside, a few naked bulbs illuminated mismatched dinette sets, three-legged chairs, two-legged tables, propped on three-legged tables. Old black folks, young black folks, no white folks. Band was setting up near the door. We pulled together enough pieces to make a place for us to sit, fetched beers from the bar where Margaret was running the place single-handedly. Sipped, sat back, expectant. Blues drummer Sam Carr, the son of legendary 30s blues guitarist Robert Nighthawk, was there that night. He came over to our table right away, shaking hands, telling us that we were welcome there and that he was happy that we came. "Have a good time," he said, his eyes sparkling. He was dutied up in a slick suit and a felt fedora. Didn't take long before Roger was accosted by the local call girl's father, who spoke of her lascivious menu, never mind that this was right there in front of me. She trotted by in her red high heels. Roger agreed to dance with her, but declined her other favors. The music began to play. When I returned from the restroom, a junkie was nodding off at the table next to us. A woman, Darla said it was his mother, came in and threw down a tiny, square, cellophane envelope. "Here," she said. Briefly alert, he swiped the white powder packet into his pocket. Darla began making her rounds with the Polaroid land camera, snapping flash photos of all the couples. She would wave the print in the air to dry, and then all heads would lean in, smiles wide, to see the results. Margaret was pouring Dixie cups of moonshine for a buck apiece. The music was getting louder. Mellow blues, followed by mournful, evocative blues. Hardcore blues. At about 11:45, local call girl's daddy stood up. He bent over so that we'd catch his meaning, tapping the face of his watch as he looked at us. We took the hint. The soulful, haunting music followed us out the door, floating around us like a ghost as we loaded back into the Cadillac. Mike put it in drive and turned around in the parking lot to head out. dust clouds flying as our headlights illuminated the asphalt. The music stayed with me as we headed back over the tracks to the highway to home.
Linda Summersee is the pen name of Linda Hebert, a retired art teacher who has taught thousands of students during her Arkansas Artist in Education residency throughout the state. She has called Arkansas her home for 25 years and now writes passionately from a cottage on Beaver Lake near Eureka Springs. Her Quilting with the Blues is in the permanent collection of the Delta Cultural Center. Next, Russell Geyer's trip is memorable in more ways than one in What Happens in New Orleans.
The convenience store door flew open with such force, the cardboard signs on top of the gas pumps quivered in fear. A middle-aged woman stormed out onto the sidewalk and narrowed her eyes like Dirty Harry. She scanned the parking lot before settling her glare on the only two punks that needed killing. "Hey, Robert," I said, applying extra pressure to the scrubber side of the squeegee against the front of the van. "What's the last thing that goes through a bug's mind when he hits the windshield?" Robert grinned. He knew the answer, but was too polite to deliver the punchline in mixed company. The woman's deadly stare locked on target the nanosecond she heard his name. She shifted her weight from one side to the other, fingers flexing around the handle of her purse. For a moment, I could have sworn the theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was wafting through the outdoor sound system. After what seemed like an eternity, she exhaled slowly and walked to her car, never taking her eyes off Robert. "Did you see how she stared at you?" I said. "If looks could kill, there'd be a greasy spot where you're standing." "Yeah, I know. I wonder what that was about." A few minutes later, our wives, Connie and Sarah, came bouncing out of the store, giggling like a couple of schoolgirls who had just pasted "kick me" on the back of their least favorite teacher. The four of us piled into the van and headed west on I-40. We were somewhere between Conway and Clarksville and shouldn't have to stop again until we saw the welcome home hills of Northwest Arkansas. It had been a fun and exciting week in New Orleans. We explored the French Quarter, visited the white sandy beaches of Gulf Shores, Mississippi. But after 8 days of living the high life, we were physically and mentally drained and longing for the familiarity of our own beds. The trip had been planned several months in advance when Sarah ran across a two-bedroom apartment just off Bourbon Street that offered weekly rates. The online photos looked great, and the price was reasonable, especially considering the location. We agreed it probably wasn't as nice as the pictures, but all we needed was a place to sleep, shower, and fix breakfast. How bad could it be? The girls were in high spirits when we left Fayetteville at 5 a.m. on Friday morning. By 10:30, they could wait no longer and declared the bar officially opened with a toast to happy hour in vacation land. We took I-40 East, skirted around Memphis, and cut straight through Mississippi. "Connie, did I ever tell you about my job at the cookie factory in Jackson?" I pointed to a road sign announcing the first exit to the city. "No, really? When did you work there?" "It was a summer job," I lied. "I was responsible for adding raisins to the oatmeal cookie batter. Everything went fine till we ran out of raisins." "What happened then?" "I substituted smart pills. That is, till my boss ate one and fired me." "Oh, no. Why'd he do that?" "He said those smart pills taste like rabbit poop." To which I replied, "See? You're getting smarter already." Robert and Sarah burst out laughing. Connie shook her head and grinned. "Why do I believe anything that comes out of your mouth?" By late afternoon, we were crossing Lake Pontchartrain and rubbernecking at every swamp shack visible from the highway. Aluminum John boats carrying dark-skinned locals raced across the stained water, heading for who knows where. It was late June, 4 or 5 years before Katrina came to sweep away their homes and take many of them with it. An hour later, we found ourselves on a street so narrow, two compact cars couldn't meet without their side mirrors slapping high five. Our MapQuest directions led us to a large opening in a brick and plaster wall. Once inside, confronted with a cluster of hallways and stairs resembling something from an M.C. Escher painting. With a little help from someone who spoke more Creole than English, we found the door to our apartment. It was locked, and there was no key in the mailbox. Robert called the landlord. He promised to show up with a key in 10 minutes. We piled our luggage on the sidewalks and slumped down in the grilling humidity to wait. I'm not sure how long 10 minutes is supposed to be in New Orleans, but you'd need a 12-month calendar to time this guy. When he finally did show, he offered no apologies, took our money, and gave us a key. We never saw him again. And as slow as he moved, I doubt he made it out when they evacuated the city a few years later. The living room, dining area, and kitchen was all one open space. The furnishings were old and worn, but functional. And the most important appliance, the refrigerator, was in good working order. Robert and Sarah took the bedroom with a balcony facing the street, and Connie and I moved into one nearest the kitchen. Both rooms were so small you had to turn sideways to walk around the bed, and the shared bathroom was more like a closet with plumbing. Still, we had no problem making ourselves at home. In a matter of minutes, the four of us were sitting on the balcony, cold drinks in hands, watching horse-drawn buggies carry tourists down the cobblestone back streets of the French Quarter. The first night, we took it pretty easy. Went to dinner, walked up and down Bourbon Street, and crashed. The 14 hours on the road, we needed to recharge our internal batteries. The last thing I remember before fading into oblivion was hearing Sarah yelp, whimper, and mutter a few cuss words. It's amazing what 8 hours of sleep can do, though. And after a hearty breakfast of double-strength Bloody Marys, we were ready to sample beignets at Café du Monde, explore Jackson Square, and tour the rest of the French Quarter. Naturally, the girls wanted to see and touch every single item and every single trash and trinket store along the way. Robert and I lumbered along behind like a couple of disinterested pack mules. Every night at bedtime, Connie and I would hear thumping noises from the other room, followed by yelps and a string of expletives from Sarah. One morning, Connie asked her about it. "What's all that beating and banging going on in there? Sounds like you guys are having a wild time." "I wish," said Sarah. "The bed is so close to the wall, I keep banging my legs every time I walk around to my side." She pulled up one leg of her pants and revealed a patchwork of black and blue bruises from her ankle up to her knee. "Ouch, those look awful. I believe I'd make Robert switch sides, or at least crawl over. You won't be able to wear shorts in public for a month." A couple of days later, we packed up the van and headed to Northwest Arkansas. The gas gauge was nearing empty when we pulled into a convenience store in front of a not-on-the-map spot west of Conway. Robert filled the tank and I cleaned the windshield while the girls hit the restroom. The first stall was occupied, so Connie and Sarah took the next two. "Dang, I've got a lot of bruises on my legs," said Sarah. "Well, if you'd treat Robert better, he wouldn't have to beat you so much," Connie said. "Oh, you know Robert doesn't beat me," Sarah said with a laugh. "Sarah, people who are in abusive situations are always in denial." The woman in the first stall finished her business and left in a hurry. "Do you think she overheard what we were talking about?" asked Sarah. "I'm sure she did," Connie giggled, "and I bet she'll remember it the next time she hears the name Robert."
From Fayetteville, Arkansas, Russell Gayer's only saving grace is marrying way over his head. The fact that poor sweet Connie has tolerated his antics since 1975 is a testament to her angelic patience and sympathetic heart. His grown children, Greta and Jesse, look at their dad and shake their heads, praying that most of their DNA came from Mom. In our final story of the night, Vicki Taylor Penny and her friends have more than one obstacle to overcome on the road in Oh Dear.
To call it a headlight was true flattery. Actually, the headlamp had been shattered, and the wire holding the pitiful little bulb was suspended about 6 inches off the pavement. It was the only illumination we had. It had been a long evening at school. As music majors, we were often called on to provide entertainment for various university functions. Tonight was one of those nights, and it was a Friday night. which meant we'd be heading home for the weekend. The University of Arkansas at Monticello was, and as far as I know, still is a beautiful place. Dorms, classrooms, administration buildings spread across the slightly rolling campus. In the days before cell phones, students would wander the campus freely without feeling the need to consult parents or peers. It was a special time. The school was also considered a suitcase college, meaning most students left campus on the weekends, and my friend Tony and I were no different. Tony was a good Catholic boy. He would only eat McDonald's McFish sandwiches on Friday and always tried giving up cursing for Lent. He forever fell short of his goal. After all these years, I wonder if he ever succeeded. My brother Larry had recently begun attending UAM, and although not truly a music major, he inadvertently walked into choir auditions, sang, and subsequently became a scholarship member of the group, and therefore allowed to hang out in the music facilities and attend performances and practices. The accidental singer had also become our chauffeur on those late nights back home to Pine Bluff. Now, I don't know if it was the car or my brother's driving habits, but small animals seemed to be driven to suicide whenever we approached. Many a raccoon, squirrel, armadillo, and even the occasional hormonal skunk met with their fate in an ill-timed roadway excursion. For the ride home, Tony would stretch out in the back seat, and I would recline into the passenger seat. It would take us less than 5 minutes to drift off to sleep. Larry would tolerate our snoring for the duration of the drive, and that was really a challenge considering it was an hour drive through the dark and lonely piney woods of southeast Arkansas with no radio. Now, the car had a radio, but in 1985, Monticello had only one radio station, and it stopped broadcasting at 9 o'clock, much to the relief of many listeners. On this Friday night, we assumed our regular positions, and I drifted off to sleep with my brother at the wheel. Now, I don't know how long I was out before I heard a word I won't repeat here. I popped my eyes open just in time to see deer smash into the front of our car. Now, deer, like fish, is one of those words that refer to both the single and the multiple of the creature. In this case, two large furry deer decided life wasn't worth it and hurled their bodies into the car. We were left with no dashboard lights, one headlight, if you could call it that, and with the fenders bent in at 45-degree angles toward the grill, giving the car a nice snowplow look. We still had a long way to get home. Miraculously, that Mercury Lynx just kept moving. Tony and I, now fully awake, assumed positions to aid with navigation. I stuck my head out the passenger side window and Tony out the other side. We took turns barking orders to Larry as he lined the wounded vehicle up on the center line. Tony peppered his instructions with colorful language. Who knew he had begun something that would commonly be referred to in future generations as performance poetry? You see, it's not necessity that's the mother of invention. It's frustration. Now, to some of you, driving a wounded vehicle down the middle of the road may seem risky, but on that small two-lane highway between Monticello and Pine Bluff, it was totally safe. Trust me. Tony then says, "Do you think the deer are off the road? I mean, I'd hate it if someone ran over them." It was silent in the car. Then he added, "Might cause a bad accident. You know how people drive out here." My brother gritted his teeth. I know because I heard him. Slowly, he brought the car to a stop. Leaning way out the windows, Tony and I gave instructions to maneuver the turnaround. We drove back to the scene, positioning the car to utilize the lone headlight bulb. We all verified both deer were on the side of the road and were very, very dead. So, back in our newly customized car, we plodded on. The attack of conscience had cost us precious time. The motor had begun making ominous noises which echoed into the night, and the occasional whiffs of steam oozed from the hood. On that dark, lonely stretch of road, the only thing we were missing now was the disheveled hitchhiker with a chainsaw. Where are the police when you need them? Now, 2 hours later, in the car gasping its last breaths, we rolled into our driveway. Inside, I called the authorities to make the police report. I notified the state police. Although we were unclear about which county the accident happened, we knew we were in Arkansas. Especially when the officer asked, "So, what'd you do with the meat?"
Vicki Taylor Penny lives in the northwest corner of Arkansas in Lowell, where she enjoys sharing stories with family and friends. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Arts Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. And thank you to ULR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody. Shoes on their feet.
coming to an end. It's the Great Depression of 2010.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers' Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.